We got another day of NBA action. And with FanDuel, every night is a watch party. So it's time for your FanDuel crew to make their bets. So, what's the move tonight, gang? You know the new customers who bet $5 get $150 back in bonus bets? Woohoo! We're heating up, fam! Bet all the stars with all your friends and make every moment more, only on FanDuel. New customers bet $5, get $150 back in bonus bets. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sports book.
It goes down in the DM. It goes down in the DM.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Ah yes, the magnificent Trolley Sour Bright Crawler, also known as Trollicus brightolus. The worm's captivating neon colour makes it an easy gummy prey.
Trolley!
It's a surprisingly sour, invitingly chewy, staggeringly snackable species unlike anything else found on this planet.
Eat me!
Delicious. Visit Trolley.com to shop now.
Trolley, eat me!
Does picking an outfit have you running a little too fashionably late? We get it. Great taste takes time. That's why Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery, has your back with the largest selection of beer, wine, and spirits delivered in under 60 minutes. Convenience never goes out of style. So if you need to spend some extra time in the mirror instead of at the store, download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's DRIZLY.com today.
Venture X from Capital One is the travel card for people always asking,
where next?
You earn 10x miles on hotels and rental cars and 5x miles on flights booked through Capital One Travel and 2x miles on everything else you buy with Venture X. Plus, receive premium travel benefits like access to over 1,300 airport lounges. The Venture X card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
It's episode 37 of the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. I'm Ray Kubb.
I'm Marcus in the Darkest.
And we have a guest in the studio tonight, Marcus.
I am so excited.
He and I have known each other a long time, back to the glory days of Rough House Records. He is the author of Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip-Hop Culture, published by Diversion Books. My friend Chris Schwartz is here. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Ray. Thanks for having me, Marcus. Thanks for having me up to your place.
Have you ever been to MMR Studios before with your long time in Philly?
The old MMR Studios.
Down at Rittenhouse?
Down Rittenhouse, yes. Square.
Okay, so
yes,
you haven't been to the Bala one?
No. As a matter of fact, it was a good thing I went online before I left my house, because I was actually headed down to Rittenhouse.
Had a double check.
But I guess the rents got a little pricey down there. Huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was all corporate moves and stuff. Nobody really wanted to ever move out of that place. It was perfect right there in the neighborhood.
It was nice. Huh? You know, I remember when IOQ used to be at the,
right,
the
train station.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, the train station.
The early days. YSP
and YSP. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, those were the three stations.
Yeah.
You know? And then you had WHAT, and then, you know, later on, obviously WDS, and then earlier on for me, it was WFIL.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Don Rose.
We talk about Famous 56 regularly here on the podcast because we're a little Philly-centric. Marcus grew up in Denver. You're a Philly guy. You grew up in the main line, right?
I grew up in Devon, and it was you'd get up at, you know, 6 in the morning to get the bus to go to St. Monica's, and it would be Dr. Don Rose playing Sky Pilot and talking with the reverb and everything in the morning.
Wow.
You know?
And the school bus would play that on the way?
No, while waiting, you know, while you're getting ready to go to school.
Transistor
I had a bunch
radio,
of older brothers and sisters, and they all were, you know.
You wrote your book. It came out in June of 2019. How long did you plan to write the book? How long was that whole process of writing Rough House, From the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip Hop Charts?
Let's see. I'll tell you I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. So there's a woman who used to work for me named Kay Vaughn, who was my controller for Rough Nation, which was the label after Rough House when I was going through Warner Brothers. Actually, Kay did work for Rough House too, but she was my head person who controlled all the money. So Kay had is now works for different production companies and film production companies. And she said, you know, you should really write a book because it would do well. And there's this resurgence happening for 90s hip hop and opportunities for documentaries and the like and all that stuff. And even then, I kind of felt like, you know, it just feels like everything, even though it happened a long time ago, it just felt like it happened yesterday. It felt too soon. And she would call me because she would fly back and forth from the East Coast to West Coast. And she would call me from the airport. And it was like, once a week, I'd get these phone calls. And I finally said, you know what? Let me look into doing this. So, you know, I've been an avid reader, a voracious reader all my life. But when it comes to writing a book, I didn't really know where to start. So I do what everybody else does. You go on the internet and look it up. And it's like, okay, you need to find an agent. Do a query letter. So I sent out query letters, right? And I thought they looked really great. I sent them out to like probably 50 agents over the course of a couple of weeks. And I was getting shot down left and right. And what happened was, I started sending them over to Britain because I figured, you know, they're into Rough House over there and maybe I'll get somebody, you know. And I had sent a couple to Scotland because I was trying to find the agency that represented the Trainspotting book, you know. So I get an email one afternoon and it's this guy and he introduces himself. He's an agent in Scotland and he had just gotten my query letter. It just come in and he was on his way out the door to go see Nas and Miss Lauryn Hill doing a show.
Wow. The story of how you get around to doing the book sounds like other things in the book, the way things happen in your life. People telling you, nah, and not seeing what you saw. Nas calls you a visionary right there on the cover of the book. But I noticed that it's a recurring theme throughout the book. Things people tell people, yeah, that too. But also people telling you, what the fuck are you doing here? Mm-hmm. And then the next thing you know, it all comes into focus. The right things happen, a little serendipity, and then and you're on to the next level. Like when you move from working for the label in Philly and moving on to the next thing that led to the next thing. But get back to you about your the hookup on
no,
the
No, I
book.
Get what you're saying. No, it's definitely serendipity. I always say be most expecting when you're least expecting. So, yeah, so he emails me and he's telling me this whole thing. He goes, look, he goes, I can't represent you, but I'll tell you what you need to do. He goes, you need to do a nonfiction proposal. And I'm like, well, what's that? He goes, it's like a book report. And
we did those in Catholic school.
It's been 50 years,
so
dude.
He actually sends me, his agency represented this guy who wrote a book about Elton John's Pandemonium years out in L.A. So he sent me that template of like how it's supposed to be set up. You know, your overview, your author bio, then your chapter breakdown, like all that. So I put that together in like a day. I sent it out to 15 agencies. And the day after the next, I'm suddenly gotten all these emails. And top, like Trimark or Trident Group, they're like the biggest agency in the country. And two of their top agents wanted to represent me, right?
Holy cow.
But, and I don't want to disparage them or anything like that, but the very first agent that got me on the phone was a woman who was with a big agency in New York, and she lives in New Orleans, and she was more versed on Rough House than and she knew everything. She knew the artists and all that, and she had not been an agent for long, but she had been in rights management for like 14 years. So I said, this is my person.
You knew by talking to her and the fact that she knew and respected your label and your work that she was the person to work with.
Yeah, and then she got me a book deal in like a week and a half.
And then how long did it take you to write the book from there?
It took me, I want to say, about maybe 4 months or so. I will say this, 4 months to get the manuscript done and sent in. But what really, when you're in the editing phase, you just cannot wait for it to be over. You know what I mean? It's like, oh my God. And you suddenly realize, but then you think about these like real writers that write these books and it's like, yeah, that's why those guys have like
Stephen King money.
No, but they all have been to like, they've been schooled in this, you know, and they've been English majors and everything like that. And it all comes so easy to them. But when you're a schlub off the streets like me, it's, you know, it's.
You're not a schlub off the streets, but a great Yiddish word, by the way.
I've got a ninth grade education. And, you know, I think if I need to, I can talk eloquently enough and I can write eloquently enough. But it doesn't come as easily to me as I think it does to other people.
One of the first things I learned from reading your book, I didn't know you were a Navy guy, so thank you for your service.
You're welcome.
You had a different kind of Navy experience than you set out for.
Yeah, it was... Yeah, that was, you're talking about the choice of duty station?
Yeah.
I know. You know, Christian Swain, he knows that whole area. He knows it.
Rock and roll archaeologist?
Yeah. What happened was when I went to my, after boot camp, they sent me to school in Memphis. And in my school in Memphis is where I learned about aviation, you know, electronics and, you know, computers and guidance systems for bombs,
the
rockets,
stuff that you
missiles.
Can take out of the Navy with you, right?
Yeah. You know, these planes have these big Gatling guns on them and like, everything about heat-seeking missiles, TV-guided bombs, all that stuff, right? And that's what I went to school for in Memphis. And in my school, I was number 3 in the class when we graduated. One of the guys in front of me got busted for weed, so now I was number 2. And then the guy who was number 1, he just wanted to go to San Diego. That was it. That's where he wanted to go. So now I had my choice.
Free reign, right.
Yeah, I had my choice. All these exotic duty stations. I could have gone to Guantanamo Bay if I wanted to. I could have gone to Hawaii, all these places. But I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a musician. And I wanted to be in L.A. So I took the closest place to L.A.
Right.
And it was exactly one halfway point between L.A. and San Francisco. And
didn't you have a couple of your siblings that moved out there by
then? Yeah. My brother Bob, who I love, and my sister Meg and my sister Ann all moved out there. So there was this pamphlet. They had these brochures for these duty stations. So we're all looking at these brochures and deciding, you know. And I'm looking at the front of this brochure, and it has this, like, very idyllic scene, like waterfalls and canoeing and the sequoias. Yes. Very like a Shangri-La, right? And I'm like, wow, this place looks beautiful. I can't wait. So cut to my sister and my brother-in-law are driving me up. We're driving up I-5 from L.A. We get to the Fresno exit, make a right, and we're driving down this road for like 40 miles. And all I'm seeing is dirt for like ever, like desert.
Oh, my.
And what was like really bad was like the little oil things look like hobby horses, you know, that go up and down. They paint them to look like horses. They put these big eyes and mouse on them.
Oh, yeah, they're all over. So
yeah, in North Dakota, they have them, too.
And I'm looking at these things, like sitting in the backseat of the car, looking out the window, and I'm thinking, what did I do? And then when I started to see Navy housing, when they dropped me off, I checked into the base, went to the barracks, and I dumped my sea bag in my room. I went out and walked around, and the air was insecticide, like thick, like a I'd never smelled this before. I didn't know what this was. I'm like, what is that smell? And finally I said, what is that? And he goes, oh, yeah, it was all industrial farming, and that insecticide was like
sprayed
everywhere. Yeah.
Back before they knew any better.
So before you got to California, you were in Nashville, correct?
Yeah,
or Memphis, with Beale Street, Stax Records, Sun Records.
Oh, yeah.
And you were listening to the black music stations. I'm a little too young to have experienced that. What were those music stations like? Because I've heard great stuff about the music that was coming out of the black stations in the 60s and 70s.
There is a famous, famous, famous station in Memphis, and I'm sure it's still there, but it was... See, here's the thing about Memphis. It was this really cool about it. Memphis is primarily a blues place,
right?
But it's real integrated, you know what I mean? And you have a lot of really like cool white artists and cool African-American artists all doing the same thing,
right?
Which to me was really interesting. And the other thing about Memphis too, and I talk about in the book, I remember I was walking, I wanted to go down to the rail yards, right? Because I wanted to look at trains, because I spent my childhood walking up and down railroad tracks. And I wanted to go see, because I heard they had a lot of really cool trains, some older trains, like, you know, from back in the day. So I went down there, and it was like, when I was walking there, I went through a bunch of predominantly black neighborhoods. And, like, I could hear gospel choirs on every street corner.
Wow.
On a Sunday morning. And it was like...
Oh, music coming out of the churches and into the street.
It was crazy, man. Wow. And you know what the thing is? I was a little bit of a wimp. I wanted to go up in some of these churches and hang out, you know? Like,
yeah?
You know, but I didn't know... You know,
I didn't know anybody.
I'm 17 years old, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, you know, it's like...
Awkward teenager.
Yeah, awkward teenager. I'm going to suddenly show up in somebody's congregation. But it was really, really cool. And, you know, I got involved with, you know, Frank Virtue later on when I got out of the service. And he recorded... recorded a lot of gospel stuff, and I helped them with it. And it really gave me, I think, a foundational appreciation for real singing.
But you learned a lot. You mentioned Frank. You learned a lot working with him, for him, around that time. It gave you room to think outside the box for yourself as far as things, and publishing was one of the things you were looking at, and all the different things that you could get into. What kind of formed up the idea that what ended up happening with Rough House, what kind of formed that up in your head? At what stage did you really get the idea that you might have, like, what it takes to create that?
Oh, well, I didn't really have that type of confidence when I was doing it. I may have come off like I did, but quite honestly, I did. Because I was learning as I went along. Yeah. I got to tell you, I made some, you know, and I say in the book, I made a lot of mistakes.
You made some big mistakes.
Yeah.
And
like,
they were ballsy mistakes, though.
Well, I got to tell you this. I'm going to give you an example. You remember Executive Slacks, right?
Sure.
Yeah. All right. I was managing them and Schooly at the same time. And I did a record on them. We did a remake. They did a cover of Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll on the Fire and Ice record. So we did this really banging remix of it, man. It was awesome. 12-inch. So I had this 12-inch record. So they were signed to this label called Fundamental Records, a little independent label, and they were licensed typically to a company over in Amsterdam called Play It Against Sam. So Play It Against Sam wants the 12-inch. I said, okay, well, I'm getting ready to master it, and you know, I'll send it over. They said, you know what? You know, we'll do that for you. Just send it to us, and we'll send you the stamper so you can manufacture over there. You don't have to spend the money. I'm like, wow, you guys are really cool, right? So now, I remember at the time, this company's like a two-man operation over there, Play It Against Sam. I met one of the guys I talked to years later. It was funny. And they spoke very good English, and it was in Belgium. And I'm waiting for the stampers calling. Suddenly, nobody speaks English, right? And then when I finally do get somebody, oh, there was a strike at the metal plant, and this and that, right? By the time I got that package that was sent like 10th class, you know what I mean?
Oh.
By steamship, right? And the stampers are in it. So now, what do? I got the stampers. I go and I get 2,000 records pressed up, right?
Okay.
Now I'm getting ready to go to the distributors. We already got it. We already bought it. We already got it. They already flooded our, they already shipped it over here and everything then. So that, but
I
that was.
That's the kind of stuff that you were saying as examples. There are other things too along the way, but somehow you always manage to turn it around. You know what I mean? Or find your way past this obstacle to get around it. And then, I mean, along the way, you start out as a musician, you know, playing around. You were talking
EDM.
About hanging around MMR in the old days in Rittenhouse Square. I haven't been there.
Right.
That was the days of when all the clubs all the way out to the river on South Street, the Hunt Club and everything was.
I played in a band when I got out of the Navy. First, I played with my best friend growing up, Jeff. We did electronic
Jeff
music.
Jeff Coulter.
Yeah, all electronic music, and we were into it. We're big Kraftwerk fans. But then we, as that band, because WXPN had Star's End and Dias Part, and they played our stuff all the time, and we did live broadcasts from WXPN. They sponsored shows for us. We were part of this electronic music scene. It was awesome. I couldn't believe
it. Really was.
I couldn't believe it. I was we'd go do a show at St. Mary's, and people are or the Painted Bride, and people are showing up, and they're paying like $9 to see us. Like,
this is 70s.
All right, now this is where I'm going to blow Marcus's mind. Here on the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. You and I have that in common. I was playing music with my wife at the time. We got to know John. We ended up playing late night, just like you guys were describing, bringing your stuff up and playing at the XPN studio in 39th and Walnut, right?
Right.
Whoa.
So I know we weren't there at the same time, but we were doing the same thing on a different night. A couple different times. So this was going on, and it created this whole scene, and these guys were in the middle of it because, well, my ex could play. I was more of a plunker, you know. But you guys got really into it, and had a Roland drum machine that ended up being a centerpiece as part of the future.
Yeah, Jeff was a drummer, so... We're listening to these records by these German artists, Klaus Schulze, Tangerine Dream.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember Tangerine Dream.
Right.
Sure. So, Kraftwerk's Autobahn is a legendary record.
We performed that entire album version at the East Side Club. Jeff and I performed it there. And here's the amazing thing. Autobahn, right? The three longest playing songs in the history of AM pop radio are Autobahn, Inagata DeVita, and Tubular Bells, right?
Right.
Autobahn, WFIL used to play a 21-minute version of Audubon.
Really?
And see, people talk about AM radio, but people don't know AM radio.
You're
AM
right.
radio was actually dope in its day.
Yeah, absolutely.
They played everything,
you're right.
Man.
They played the full versions. They didn't do radio
cool
singles.
Stuff because it was
you're
AM
right.
radio.
Well, there were stations. This isn't an across-the-board statement about it, because some people did play the edited singles. And the other thing that they did was they would, they would record them on carts. Like we would play in radio, we used to play the commercials on them, but they would play the songs off them and they would speed the fucking carts up they could get more songs into the hour. But I digress, which we often do here, by the way, on the imbalance.
Well, we were talking about the drum for the Roland TR-8. So up until then, right, the only real drum machines on the market were either ones that were built into your Wurlitzer organs that you had in your living room.
Oh, right.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the salsa, the samba, right? So Roland Corporation had a machine called the CompuRhythm. And the CompuRhythm was like this box. And who used CompuRhythms? Well, when you go to the bar and the guy's playing the acoustic guitar, he's got the CompuRhythm. Yeah. It had like 8 beats on it, right?
Okay, yeah, the one man 8-piece band.
But that's all it did, right?
Right.
So we're listening to groups like Klaus Schulze, T-Dream, and Kraftwerk. And we're like, how are they doing this? How are they having these drums along with this, like, working and everything? And Jeff figured it out that they were using these clock-generated sequences, and they were synthesizing actual drum sounds. Like, you know,
right.
I've got to tell you something. When you look at the body of Kraftwerk's work, right, in that day and age, and you look at what went into making those records.
What they had to do.
People
what
like
they
Daft,
had to do.
Daft Punk and everything, everybody has Pro Tools and editing and all that stuff.
They couldn't do this.
They're pretty talented guys. I love
Daft
Punk.
A lot of the today people couldn't do it,
But the thing is, that's the thing, when you listen to Kraftwerk, the purity of it, like the analog thing.
Makes it more amazing.
So we're reading this. Jeff found an article in some magazine and talked about where the Roland Corporation was coming out with a programmable drum machine. It was like, we had to have this. And the great thing about it was that, you know, you have all your sounds that are so iconic, especially in the world of hip hop, you know, hand claps, cowbell, kick drum, snare, woodblock, right? Each instrument has its own output. So you can now, not only can you program it, you can actually run that output through its own channel in the board. You can mix it, and then when you're playing live, it's like, you know, when you mic a drum, that's one thing, but when you have an output coming out of a drum machine, that's like
pure
big.
Yeah,
it's
it
a
is.
Metaphysical experience, right? So what happened was, we were the first people to have this, but we weren't thinking about hip-hop at the time.
No.
Hip-hop really, it existed, but what really existed was electro-funk and breakdancing. Hip-hop, rap, which is a thing that you do. It's not a term for something.
Where did the Sugar Hill Gang come into this?
That's what I was going to get to that. So that was like, there was two things, right? You had groups like Curtis Blow, the Sugar Hill Gang, Grandmaster Flash and everything. But what was really driving radio was the electro-funk stuff. Nucleus, right? But the two records that really kind of like gave birth to like the breakdance nation was Space is the Place by Afrika Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force, right? Produced by Arthur Baker, right? What they did was they took Kraftwerk's Trans-Europe Express and they put a whole separate like breakbeat under it, right?
Okay.
And then they did their ad-lib rap parts over it. That song was like the bridge between the Germanic electronic music and the American breakdance music.
Whoa.
The breakdance movement. This is important. This
that
is an important.
You're learning on the imbalanced history of rock.
This is an important event in the history of hip hop, because if it had not happened, I personally don't know if hip hop would have cross-pollinated and become this thing. And then what came after that? Kraftwerk Numbers, right? Numbers, basically, now you could not break dance with a track like Numbers, you know?
Right.
So that was it. And that's what really, to me, was the initial fire that drove radio. Because anytime you had anything with just rapping, okay, I could not help but constantly notice how the R&B A&R would try and glom onto it and make it into an R&B thing
you know?
And like what they did within Billboard when they established the Hot Rap Singles chart for the first two 2 weeks, it was all rap records, right? And then the third week, you're starting to see these R&B records slip in there because there's like, you know, half a bar of rap in it. You know what I mean? Mm. And it became like a mark. Oh, well, we'll put a rap out. That way you can get on another chart, you know?
Interesting about Afrika Bambaataa, because I know him from his work with Johnny Rotten in the 80s, World Destruction, which was a big cheesy
great
suburban
record.
White kids dancing at
I was a massive Pill fan.
Oh, God, and Pill
Riding
was great.
Riding through the forest in a Japanese car.
And
I'll never
Seattle.
Forget the impression you made. Left the hole in the back of my head.
This is not a love song. Oh, yeah, Pill was great.
You know, we went on tour with Schoolie. We went on tour with Big Audio Dynamite. You know, that was the actual first ever hip-hop tour of Europe. In Britain and everything, and we were playing in front of predominantly Clash fans.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
A lot of bottles and cans, not just on stage, sometimes at the hotel.
Oh, I'm sure.
But out of the, like, say 3,000 people that would show up, there's like 12 to 15 there that are into this hip-hop thing. But for some, like in Scotland and parts of Ireland, it was bizarre. They're like, people have never seen an MC and a DJ.
That's crazy.
They didn't know what to make of it.
That's crazy. Was Mick Jones still bummed about the way things ended with Joe Strummer at that point, even though he was doing really well with Big Audio Dynamite?
I don't think he was really thinking about that. And, you know, have you ever seen the Clash documentary?
I've seen a bunch of them.
It really kind of like, it seems like Mick Jones was really had more to gain by...
Yeah.
It seems like he was on his own thing the whole time. I don't know. I could be wrong. I didn't ask him about it.
It's the Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll. Ray Coob and Marcus in the Darkest with our guest Chris Schwartz. We're going to take a pause for the cause, the pause that refreshes, and we'll be right back with more with Chris talking about his book all about Rough House and the streets of Philly. Well, you know, Marcus, we talk about the guys at Crooked Eye Brewery so much, we should make them like partners in the podcast.
And they should make us partners in the brewery.
Well, I'd like that because I get to go and drink all the good stuff for free, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, you may not get to go and drink for free, but you can go and have a great time anytime you go into Crooked Eye. They're in the heart of Hatboro, right at York Road and Montgomery Avenue. Stop on in and have anything that's fresh off the board. There's so many great offerings. Jeff Mulhare and the Chief Brewer always work. Working on some neat stuff in the back room. Their new expanded brewing facility, Marcus. We saw it when we did the New Year's Eve party.
Yeah, the facility's great. It's got great sound to record a podcast in, which means...
But it also makes good beer.
Yeah. And we...
If you want to go in with friends and you don't drink beer, they've got wine and cider and all kinds of things, especially in the wintertime. There's always a hearty ale or something that you can quench your thirst with there at Crooked Eye. You want to find out what's going on entertainment-wise, you can go to their website, crookedeyebrewery.com.
Good friends, great beer. Next time you need a pint, make it a Crooked Eye right in the heart of Hatboro.
Well, we're sitting with Chris Schwartz, and we're talking about the burden of running your own social media. It's big, isn't it?
It is.
You know that.
I can't say I was into the idea, and my publishers said, you know, like, if you don't start getting into this, you're going to be destined for loserdom as a writer. And
you got to do what you got to do. Wait, you're getting into podcasting, aren't you?
Yeah.
Wait, are you going to have to have a whole other thing going on?
Wait till you do that.
I already taped four episodes.
Cool.
I only run seven Facebook pages and two Twitter accounts and an Instagram.
You're going to have to hire a full-time social media person.
Well, I have to say this, that, you know, our podcast, we did four of them in one day. And it was with, you know, School ED is my co-host, and along with
God, that's awesome.
With a woman named Laia St. Clair, who also used to work for me, that went into radio. And she also is a co-host on Questlove Supreme, which was the first podcast I did. But yeah, it was fun, man.
Yeah, it is fun. We talk about a lot of stuff, but we also have a lot of fun, as you can tell. I know you listened to a few episodes.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about, you mentioned serendipity earlier, and so many of the things that happened to create Rough House were chance opportunities or meetings or things falling, the tumblers locking, falling through, everything falling into place. You talk about some of that stuff in the book. What do you think are the most important elements, other than meeting Joe the Butcher, in pulling that whole thing together?
The most important event for me
was
when I was working at Nicetown Records in West Philly. My office was on the third floor of this turn-of-the-century dilapidated building above a daycare center, and I was calling... uninterested retailers about uninteresting records working for this company. And I finally said, you know what? a guy named Richard Barrett. Richard Barrett, for those who don't know, was an artist, and one of his songs was one of the Beatles' favorite songs that they covered when they played The Cavern. Richard then went into production and management, and he discovered Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers,
Whoa.
And then later on, the Three Degrees, and Richard lived up the street from me in Gladwin. We both drove the exact same Rolls Royce, different colors, and, you know, we became really good friends. So anyhow, I met Richard at Nicetown Records, and he was down there looking for Ted. And I'm on the phone one day, and he comes up the stairs, and, you know, this guy comes in, and he's this elderly African-American gentleman, and he is impeccably dressed. I mean, beautiful clothes, like scarf and the shoes, cashmere coat and everything. And he's sitting on a stack of records, box of records, waiting for me to get off the phone. And we start talking, and I'm showing him, yeah, I got Added in Tuskegee and Savannah, and then I got a retailer here, and, you know, and he goes, what do you think of these records? And I think, well, they're generally not that great. He goes, well, don't you feel kind of weird calling people about them? I said, well, I'm just trying to learn the business, my job and everything. Mm-hmm. Talk to you the next time you call. I said, yeah, that's crossed my mind a few times. And then he left. And I remember I lit a cigarette and I thought about it. Did you know what? Fuck, he's right. This is like, you know, and like I wasn't like turning I was making point. A lot of money. So I figured, you know what? Let me go try my hand at, you know, and I'd gotten Joe's card when we did a session at Studio 4. It was the first time I had met him. So I decided, all right, this is going to be my last day. And an hour and a half later, I go downstairs to the owner's office, Ted. His name was Ted, owned Nicetown. And I'm talking to him about something. And I'm looking over on the wall and I see these records with these bright yellow labels on it, the magic marker. And I pick one up and I look at it and it's like, oh, Schoolie D, Gangster Boogie. I know this song. This is a great track, you know? I hear
right.
it on, you know? And I said, what are you doing with all these? And he's like, it's how Ted does. Oh, yeah. Schoolie came by to see me. He wanted me to do distribution. But, you know, I told him I wasn't interested. And I'm sitting there like, we're working a Bill Cosby live at Greater Prison.
You mentioned
that's hilarious. Yes, ironic
and
now.
A couple other, like, we did have one. We had a Bunny Sigler record that was great. I remember right. that, you know, but that was it. So, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, Schoolie D walked in here like this could. And so I went back upstairs and I sat by the window and I waited for Ted to leave. I went back down to his office.
Right.
And I got Schoolie's number out of his Rolodex and I called him up and met up with him. And I said, look.
That, by the way, when you read the book, the story of you going to meet Schoolie is fucking hysterical. Let's not give it away. So there's
you have to read it.
But you got together with him, and I mean, you guys are like joined at the hip ever since.
I told him, I said, look, man, I said, you're like a big fish in a small pond here. You're like, you're the hippest trip since buttered toast in the city of brotherly love. But you need distribution. You need like all this stuff. Because he had been doing it himself. He would go down, he'd press up records and take them down to Funko Mart. And
say, is he the first DIY hip hop guy?
Yeah, he was. It's actually, I was on this really credible hip hop podcast called Take It Personal.
Mm.
And the guys on that really know their shit. And they said he was the first legitimate independent movement in hip hop. Now, I say this with the caveat that prior to the major label colonization of the hip hop industry,
right.
which happened later on in the late 80s.
And you read about
everybody was independent. But what made Schoolie independent is that he actually drew his own label. You know,
that's amazing.
He drew his own art. Like, that was like, it was the first true independent movement. But what really, the event, serendipity, was meeting him, ended up working with him, and then he goes and makes probably one of the most important hip hop records in terms of influencing and creating a genre. And that was PSK Gucci Time, because those were the first bona fide gangster hip hop records, and it influenced Ice-T, Eazy-E, N.W.A. There'd be none of that stuff
Dre,
without, because if you listen to Eazy Does It, if you listen to Ice-T 6 AM, they're blatant copies of PSK. And they've been Schoolie. As a matter of fact, Ice-T is on a new single with Schoolie. Right, shameless plug here, called The Real Hardcore, and he talks about it in the song.
That's awesome.
You know,
right?
And it's like, and he's giving Schoolie D affirmation. If it hadn't been for you, there'd be no me, you know? Yep.
Wow.
In your book, during the whole Schoolie D early days, you talked about the Beastie Boys opening up for Schoolie D, and you also talked about Schoolie D going to L.A. and opening up for the Chili Peppers. Was that the Freaky Styley tour, or was that the self-titled debut record tour?
Freaky Styley.
The one that George Clinton produced, yes, which is a brilliant album, yes, by the way.
Yes, and all of our shit was covered with Dago Paint after the tour.
What was it like playing with the Chili Peppers in those days?
We hardly ever saw them.
Really?
Yeah, and I was told, and I don't want to believe this, okay? I was told the reason that they weren't talking to us and they weren't very friendly is because Anthony didn't like the idea of
hip-hop
opening up. Yeah.
Interesting.
And I didn't want to believe that because I was such a massive fan, you know? But, you know, there's something that I had found out since the book that is a pretty interesting trivia fact, and this was one of the most amazing things that I had ever heard. Oh, so here's what happened. My publisher calls me up and said, Chuck D just did a big thing on Instagram about your book. And it's a picture of Chuck D. He's holding the book up.
I think I saw that.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, Chuck D, shot, my God, this is the most incredible thing. So you ready for this? I go over to Schoolie's house in Manayunk at like 4:30 in the afternoon. I knock on the door. He says, come in. He's on the phone and he's talking to Chuck. And Chuck's telling him, talking about my book. And he goes, you're not going to believe, Chuck, guess who just came in here? Guess here, talk to you. And he puts me on the phone with him.
What?
And
I'm getting chilled,
like,
man.
So I'm thanking Chuck for everything. He goes, I need to tell you something. What's that? He goes, I'm going to tell you two things. First off, if it hadn't been for Schoolie D, I would have never become a rapper. Chuck D performs PSK all the time out there, right? But he talked about the first time Public Enemy ever came to Philadelphia. He had the van take him to 52nd and Parkside, and he just sat there for 2 hours in the van.
No shit.
He wanted to be at 52nd and Parkside. Yeah. And this is Chuck D.
Right.
This is like
crazy.
And
shit.
I could not believe what I was hearing. This is like the most amazing thing that this guy's telling me that he became a rapper because of Schoolie.
See, it's stuff like that that makes
but
me feel 100%
blew me,
about
it blew me away.
But Chuck
their
so
styles
much.
Are so different.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
Public Enemy's not gangster rap. They're politically charged and brilliant in a different way.
No, they're not gangster rap, but they're very, when in their at the core, they're hating.
They're hard.
They're very street and they're hard as shit.
Yes. Yes.
Well, the Roots are hard as fuck, too. And I love the Roots for that hard.
The Roots to me are more like Tribe Called Quest. They're more.
I find them to be harder than them. Tribe's got a warmth, I think, that Philly toughness that the Roots have.
It ain't Public Enemy. Come
That's
on, we're
true.
Talking about
Chuck
we're talking
D's
about
amazing.
A feel that you what, only get from makes, listening to one
what,
group.
Oh yeah.
What
That's
makes
true.
Public Enemy to me, you know, the songs like Welcome to the Terror Dome.
She watched Channel Zero.
It's just like that stuff, no matter how you shake it or bake, it just pops. It's funny because I've been going through a Public Enemy retrospective, and yeah, I really loved
Good.
It then and I love it now. I remember the first time I ever heard Rebel Without a Pause and that Terminator X turntable break. I was like, man, how does somebody think of that? You know what I mean? Just like, incredible.
These things come to artists. I play records, you know what I mean, on the radio. That's what I can play, you know? But I'm always in amazement at some of the things that come out. And you sit there and it's the things that amaze me are all so different. So you never know where it's going to come from, I guess.
I'll tell you this. And I'm going to admit something that I've never talked about in any interview. Because, you know, I guess by human nature, you want to come off like you know what you're talking about and you're confident in everything that you do and like, oh, I can pick the hit. I can hear it. Oh, that's going to work, right? Well, here's the simple reality. You know, if I look back, right, like the first Fugees record, right, which wasn't considered the greatest record, but it did the trick and everything. I didn't know what was going to happen with that record, right? But here's what I did know. I did know that at the time, I hated hip-hop. I didn't hate it. I just hated the live presentation, right?
Okay.
I was getting tired of going and see these artists, DJ and the MC, MC Mashed Potato and DJ Gravy Boat, and they're two dancers that are supposed to distract us from the fact that there's not a lot
this
going
is
on
coming
stage.
For him, buddy.
Right?
Oh,
right?
For
yeah.
So I go to see Joey and I go up to New York to manager's office, and we see this, we don't even know what it is we're looking at. There's like 8 or 9 people, right? But there's a dude playing guitar over a beatbox, and it's islandy. It's like West Indies, and it's just like, and within 45 seconds, it was like, I want.
You knew.
Right?
That instantly.
You just knew.
But they got passed on by every single label, right? And I'm thinking, well, why? And you know, it's funny. I was in an interview on Ebro in the morning on Hot 97, and Rosenberg, really cool guy, he said, I could see how they would have gotten passed on because it looked like a mess because you don't know what it is. But that was the whole thing. And I think, you know, like Cypress Hill, my God, man, that was an easy one. Listening to those demos, you know, but you don't know. You don't know, but you know it's different. You like it. You just don't know if or anybody else is going to be into it. You know?
How different were those Cypress Hill demos from the final product that you put out at Rough House?
Well, I will say this. Mugs. Well, first off, you know, it's in the production and delivery, right?
Yeah.
First off,
first time I ever at Cypress Hill, I thought there were four guys rapping because I didn't realize it's the different voices, right?
Yeah.
And then Muggs has got to be pound for pound, in my humble estimation, one of the greatest hip-hop producers out there, right? So you take that, but then you combine it with Joe Niccolo, who, Joe, look, here's the thing. I'm going to make this profession that in the 80s, what I really hated was going into a studio with a white engineer to make a hip-hop record. Because here, what's the first thing a white engineer does? He's going to take the beat, drum track, and he's going to clean it up. He's going to make it all antiseptic and clean, which makes it very flat, very unimaginative, very uninteresting, right? What does Joe Niccolo do? Joe does totally counterintuitive. He just takes it, and he makes it even more dirty and bombastic and big, right? There were three guys that did this. Arthur Baker, Rick Rubin, and Joe Niccolo. And if you look at Joe's entire body of work as a producer, everything from Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, MC Breeze, Hilltop Hustlers, Schoolie D, all the way up to the Cypress Hill Records, my God, it's like that you can't, by the time when he was at the top of his game and then Cypress comes in with Mugs and the way these guys rapped and everything, right, it was one of those perfect storms, right? Okay. And so, yeah, to answer your question, the demos were dope. The demos were absolutely amazing.
Were they produced differently?
Well, here's the thing. The songs were there. We got the first cassette that I think had like five things on it. But then while we were, you know, offering them a deal and everything, they got a demo deal from BMG Music Publishing and they went into the studio. Then we got an ADAT that had like another five songs on it. And it was like, oh, yeah, this is an album deal.
Because
that single deal went out right out the window. But here's the thing. When they won their star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, B-Real made a big deal about thanking us and saying that, you know, without Rough House, because we let them be them. Because every other label was trying to tell them, oh, don't talk about weed. Don't talk about that. Don't talk about this.
And look.
The stigma. We like, look at, they were 25 years ahead.
I didn't even smoke weed, you know, at the time. And I said, yo, man, just let the good, just let the good times roll.
Yeah.
But when that first song, Pigs, came out, it was like, Questlove was talking about, you know, before he was signed and he was a kid in the street trying to get into hip hop and everything. He said, first time we heard that record, we were like, huh? You know, like, what? You know, it's like, it's a cool song, you know?
Speaking of Questlove, I learned two things reading your book before I even got to page one. Right. First, I never knew that Amir's dad was Lee Andrews of Lee Andrews and the
Horns. You know
what?
I never knew that.
I learned that about a year ago, I think.
He never told me that till we were doing the podcast center and he wrote the foreword for the book. I was like, I never knew that either.
Wait a minute. Is that where it ends?
That's where we're going to have to cut it off.
What about the other thing? I want to know about the other thing.
Well, if you want to know about the other thing, you come back next week and listen to the other thing.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's how it works.
It is.
I'm intrigued, man. We were really rolling there with Chris Schwartz. Such an interesting guy and great guy to just hang out and talk with, man. It was so cool. And we've got a lot more things, including a couple very interesting revelations in the second part of this interview.
Yes, you definitely want to be aware of one of the revelations that happens in part two. You also want to read his book, Rough House from the Streets of Philly to the Top of the 90s Hip Hop Charts. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any bookseller. I actually saw it at a local bookstore by my house.
Nice.
So
support,
I was
the
very
local
excited.
Bookstores.
Absolutely. Support the local bookstores and check the book out. It seriously is a great read. Not only does he talk about the music, but as we touched on in the first part, Ray, he gave us some pretty cool insight about how the hip hop industry worked and
how things happen. With him too and everything at Rough House.
Yep, and things that he could have put into the book, but he chose not to because I don't know.
Second book. But, well, there'll definitely be a second part, even if there isn't a second book. So we'll be doing that. And by the way, give us your feedback if there's anything we got right or anything more you think we should know about what we're talking about in part one with Chris, Chuck D. All you got to do is hit us up at imbalancedhistory@gmail.com. That's a good way to get hold of us anytime.
Absolutely. Or you can check us out on Facebook, Imbalanced History of Rock and Roll, or Twitter as well, Imbalanced Histo.
Oh, we got to thank Santa because he brought us the RY.
Not Twitter.
We got RYs. Actually,
Santa.
Marisa got us both a little box with RY in it. Yes. The letters RY from, I guess, like Michael's Craft Store or something.
Yep.
You know?
Great.
And so we both got to shook it up. And you can see the video on both our Twitter account and on the Facebook page when Marcus gets his RY. But Twitter, come on.
Yeah, come on, Twitter. Give
Two
us the
more
RY.
Characters. It's
we're
all
almost
we
there.
Need.
After that, I think we're a little parched and might need a pint.
Well, we have to thank our friends at Crooked Eye because, you know, they've got the cure for what ails you since 2014, and they sponsor the Imbalance Podcast. That's going to wrap it up, and we're going to have to wait to hear about thing number two on part two with Chris Schwartz. I'm Ray Koob.
I'm Marcus in the Darkest.
On the Imbalance History
of Rock and Roll.
Splash Weather Repel Premium Windshield Wash features a 3-in-1 formula that repels rain, sleet, snow, and bugs while leaving a streak-free shine. And its advanced beading technology keeps you seeing safely all year long.
See safely on the road when you apply a little splash.
Pick some up at Walmart today.
The Venture X card from Capital One gives you premium travel benefits, perfect for seeing Taylor Swift the Eras Tour. Presented by Capital One. Ooh, I do love her. Earn 5x miles on flights and 10x miles on hotels through Capital One Travel.
Enjoy your stay in Suite 13.
Whoa, 13? That's Taylor's lucky number. The Venture X card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.